Welcome to Cattle HQ, a podcast from industry experts and progressive producers discussing cutting-edge info about the cow-calf sector to keep cattlemen and women in the know and positively affect their bottom line.
Welcome to Cattle HQ, brought to you by South Dakota State University Extension. I'm Olivia Amundson, cow-calf field specialist based out of the Sioux Falls Regional Center, along with my sidekick and co-host, Kiernan Brandt from the Watertown Regional Center and Robin Salverson from the Lemon Regional Center. Joining me on this episode is Dr. Bob Cushman, research physiologist at the U.S. Meat Animal Research Center in Clay Center, Nebraska, where he works to develop new knowledge, technology, and strategic approaches for improvement and optimization of biological systems, production efficiencies, and environmental sustainability of livestock production. Dr. Cushman largely invests his time in bovine reproductive physiology and understanding mechanisms related to the development of puberty in heifers and longevity of the cow herd. I am really excited to have Dr. Cushman on this episode of Cattle HQ to share his expertise in the uterine clock on cows. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Cushman.
Thank you. It's nice to be here today.
Yes, thanks. So I'm just going to throw out for our listeners, Dr. Cushman was actually one of my graduate co-advisors. And so I got to work with Dr. Cushman for 2 years, really, and got to really learn a lot about what he works on, talking about, you know, the ovary, the ovarian reserve, puberty in heifers, longevity of the cow herd. But Bob, I can only say so much about what you actually work on, and I know you work on a lot of things, but why don't you give us just a little bit more information about your work at US Mark?
Okay, so as Olivia said, the largest portion of my research, I'm trained as an ovarian physiologist, and where you'll hear others talk about the hypothalamus and the pituitary being the top end of reproduction, I will always argue that the ovary is the top end of reproduction. And my argument becomes that you can't make an ovary do what it doesn't want to do. And I also know that in my house, the ovary is boss. I don't know about your house, but in my house, the ovary is boss. So I look at it as the fact that the hypothalamus and the pituitary and the uterus are actually driven for the most part by those steroid hormones, estradiol and progesterone. And that is why we need proper priming of estradiol and progesterone for the uterus to have proper reproductive function. And again, we'll probably go into this a little bit more to make it more understandable in a few seconds, but we've had GnRH and FSH and prostaglandin and all the hormones we use for assisted reproductive technologies for decades now, and we still can't make every pair of ovaries do exactly what we want them to do, which proves that if an ovary's not ready to do what it's supposed to do, that I'm not going to say it's absolutely useless, but it's a lot more difficult to make it work right than sometimes we think it is.
And that's literally what you've invested your life's work in, is trying to manipulate that ovary. And something I should have said before is that, you know, we have had other guests on this podcast, actually, from the Great Plains Vet Education Center, which is actually, it's not in conjunction with US Mark, is it? But it's on the same site.
I mean, I like that wording that it's in conjunction. We try to keep it there. It probably becomes, in a lot of ways, the closest collaboration, at least that I have.
Okay. Perfect. And I know even when I was down there working at the Meat Animal Research Center, I did work on a project in collaboration with the Great Plains Vet Education Center. And so it is a little different. You have your vets over there, and then you have your research scientists on the other side, but you guys do work collaboratively. So just to kind of give a little bit of a idea to our listeners of what US Mark really truly all encompasses a little bit. So, you know, Bob, I also know, so since I was one of your graduate students, you've also done a lot of significant work with SDSU on some projects. And one that actually really comes to mind is how calving date affects the longevity and calf weaning weights on the herd. Do you just kind of want to start with that? Because I feel like that's a really important topic to discuss. And then we can start talking about how getting those cows pregnant and the uterine clock is important in the in this really broad picture.
Absolutely. So, and again, I would say that in some ways what we published a few years back, it's been almost a decade now, but was not necessarily new data. There were data out there going back 50 and 60 years where we've shown and known this. But the idea becomes that we've shown through the years that getting your heifers bred as early as you can as yearlings improves their reproductive longevity and their productivity. And a lot of this comes from several factors, at least in my mind. The historically, what people have been used to in terms of that concept is the idea that you get your heifers bred earlier, and that gives them an even greater amount of time to recover postpartum after they calve before their next breeding, as they are 2 year old, still continuing to grow and trying to get rebred and nurse a calf and all of that type of thing. It gives them more time to recover from dystocia or problems like that. But getting back to what Olivia said about my research in the ovarian reserve, we have been interested for a very, very long time on how the number of follicles in the ovary relates to fertility in mammalian females in general. In my case, I've actually done research on quite a number of species. And within the ovarian reserve world, there is still actually an argument going on about whether it relates to fertility or not, whether we're talking about humans or exotic species or livestock, this still becomes a philosophical debate. The one place I'll go to human medicine to kind of support my argument, even if we come back to cattle and stuff, is if you know anything about women that are having difficulty conceiving, they will eventually do an assessment of the ovarian reserve. And whether we argue about a low ovarian reserve having true fertility effects or not, if that ovarian reserve is low in those women that are trying to conceive, they have reached the point in the medical field at this point where most of the time they start trying to guide those women toward thinking about surrogates or other possibilities, because the cost of all the hormones and the cycles to try to get enough embryos is just, they've proven it's just not worth it. So I don't deny we still have data sets where we argue it back and forth, and there's still a lot we don't know about how all of this works, but you can just look at the practical human medicine side of things and say they know that it's an issue. And again, what we've shown coming back to the calving day thing and how that relates to longevity is that when you start looking at calving distributions, if you do an ultrasound prior to the start of the breeding season to get an antral follicle count to assess the size of the ovarian reserve, more of those higher antral follicle count females conceive earlier and therefore calve earlier and have a greater reproductive longevity. Again, because depletion of the ovarian reserve is what leads to menopause or reproductive senescence, we would suspect that part of that increased longevity is just due to having a better, more fertile ovarian reserve that lasts longer. Like I said, it also gives them a longer postpartum interval to recover. People tend to think about acyclicity and that those animals that are on the end of the calving season have less of a chance to be back cycling by the start of the next season. And some of that comes into play. There is an interaction between the ovarian reserve and cyclicity, but we still don't have all of that sorted out.
So Dr. Cushman, you use the word antral. Can you give a description of what antral follicles are to our listeners?
I certainly can. So antral follicles are the very last stage of follicle development. So a female is born with a finite number of eggs in her ovary, any mammalian female. They start as microscopic follicles, which is an egg surrounded by a couple of layers of granulosa cells. But as they grow up to ovulatory stage, eventually they form a fluid-filled antrum, which is where the term antral follicle comes from. And those are the follicles that you can see by ultrasound because of that fluid-filled cavity. you can't see the microscopic follicles on by ultrasound. And both in women and in exotic species and in livestock, we've been able to document through the years that if you do an ultrasound scan of the ovaries and count those follicles, that it will correlate positively with the microscopic follicles. So you have a way of estimating the size of her ovarian reserve. And again, for women in the audience, especially those that have passed through menopausal years, you know that part of the exam that goes with that usually is checking on the ovaries and looking at the follicle numbers to see where you're getting to.
I was one of those lucky individuals who got to sit on a microscope and count some of those follicles as well. So
I was actually going to say that, Olivia.
So. Yeah, that made me so dizzy, but hey, we got her done.
So I'm still going to argue, as you've heard me say, that I'm still nicer to all my graduate students because it took me years to prove to Dr. Britt that we didn't need every section out of the ovary to really show that correlation. And so
that's right.
Physicians now do not count the number of sections that I had to during my PhD.
That's right. Because putting them suckers on slides, I mean, getting every single slide, that was tough. I mean, you remember me and Liz in there sectioning those slides. Oh my gosh.
Yep.
That was an art.
It is.
I just want to just pick your brain real quickly before we move on. I think what you just said about calving date and the ovarian reserve, and even some of those late calving females, is going to set us up really well for the continuing conversation. But I just have this thought that I've Kiernan and I have, well, even Robin and I have had this conversation. You know, we want to get that young female bred as early as possible. We want her to hit puberty as early as possible so that, you know, she kind of maintains herself in the herd. What are your thoughts on waiting until that female is 2 years old to breed her?
So to me, I think the data are out there really showing that you, to some degree, you do decrease her productivity, and it is not simply about losing one calf. You can say it's about losing one calf, but I can argue that you've now put another year of depletion into the ovarian reserve. So you're actually starting them at a later point in their ovarian cycle. I still worry, truthfully, Olivia, I think a better way of saying it at this point, at least in our Bos Taurus animals, is that we want an optimal age of puberty, but I don't think we really want as early as possible, because we start getting into those females that end up coming into their first ultrasound exam at 11 months of age or whatever, already pregnant. Because if you pull the puberty age down in the heifers, you pull it down in the bull calves as well. And I know there's argument about this. When you find those 8-9-month-old heifers pregnant, there are those that think that it was the bull, the actual service bulls. I tend to have a hard time believing that's what's going on, because I just believe he would ride those young heifers into the ground, and we even see that at times. So I think it's more that connection that if you're pulling age of puberty down too much in general in your population, you've also got bull calves out pre-weaning that are able to at times service those calves. So I truthfully really like optimal better than as early as possible. I think for the most part, in the presence of acceptable nutrition, that we have most of our Bos Taurus genetics where we need them to be to have a lot of those heifers pubertal by the time we want to breed them at 13, 14 months of age.
Yeah, it was something that actually, I can't remember if it was Robin and I or Kiernan and I, but we started having that conversation, because there are people out there that do wait until 2 years of age. And I was just curious, like, you know, how, on even a financial economic standpoint, how does that work for them? But also on the longevity of that female, are they seeing benefits in waiting that long? Just
so all the literature I see still supports the idea that you've decreased all that opportunity, right? Now you've put 2 years of development costs into her, you've lost a calf. And if our ovarian reserve research is correct, which is still argumentable, you've almost put yourself in that same situation as another use for this research, even if it's in livestock, right? that idea that we have women now that want to have careers and wait until later in life to have children. And again, that is all about the fact that their ovarian reserve has started to deplete, and those are the issues we're dealing with. So in my opinion, that's the world you're putting yourself into, which doesn't mean there aren't reasons or right management practices to potentially do it. But I think that's what we're
of. I was just going to add on, I think, you know, with a couple of producers that come to mind that still calve for the first time at 3 years old, you know, they're doing it for the right reasons. They're trying to minimize dystocia and preserve longevity and, you know, those good things. They're focusing on the cow herd, which I can appreciate, but that additional year of just follicular recruitment and burning those potentially good eggs, that's a very interesting perspective on that I hadn't really considered. And I mean, from that angle, you're probably dead on. I mean, and at this stage in the game, I'm just thinking, you know, there's probably some better tools available to help minimize dystocia, so where we can push those heifers to have that calf by 2 years of age and get them started off right and not set them back by having them have a whopper 100-pound calf, or you know, selecting the right heifers to begin with to avoid having them having dystocia, some things like that.
Agreed.
Yeah, so that was definitely a rabbit trail there, but just something I thought about when we were talking about heifers and getting them pregnant. So, okay, to continue on with our conversation, though, I'm just going to kind of maybe have you set the stage a little bit in terms of, we're going to be talking about the estrous cycle, essentially, and the uterine clock, which is kind of a new term. Well, it's a new term for us, but it's definitely probably not a term that's used out, you know, in the cow-calf industry. And so, but before we get started, I think it's really important that we kind of set up our listeners so that they understand, you know, we'll be talking about estradiol, progesterone, GnRH. What are these? Well, how are these hormones utilized within the estrous cycle of these cows? Because I think it's important to set that up, so as we're having this conversation, they can at least recognize kind of where we're going.
So to kind of describe an estrous cycle without pictures, but hopefully everybody's seen pictures of an estrous cycle. An estrous cycle essentially starts the way we usually time it out is to use estrus, right? Because back before we could measure hormones or all that type of thing, the way that the early reproductive physiologists could start measuring this was to look at the behavior. So if we say that it starts with estrus is that behavioral demonstration of being willing to stand to be mounted, whether it's by another cow or by the bull. And that, of course, is driven by estrogen or estradiol, which is one of the two steroid hormones we're going to talk about. And like I said, estradiol drives behavioral estrus. It comes from those antral follicles and primarily from the one antral follicle that reaches the point where it's going to ovulate and drop the egg into the reproductive tract at that cycle. Now, the really neat thing, and again, this gets back to actually thinking about Mother Nature and how these clocks work. So when I teach reproductive physiology, I really do like to make the students think about the fact that the next structure that forms on the ovary is the corpus luteum. And the corpus luteum secretes progesterone, and the name progesterone, pro is four, and gesterone is just like gestate, so it's for pregnancy, right? And being a federal employee, just like Dr. Geary is, I love to say, if con is the opposite of pro, what's the opposite of progress? Congress. There, I got to say it. But anyway, we got off a little bit. But what's neat about that clock, right, is that the CL forms from the follicle. And why that's important is for anybody that's ever worked in embryo transfer, we get those embryos and we usually flush them out as a blastocytosis at about day 7. And if you super ovulated, then you need a bunch of females whose CLs are at that same age. So they're at day 7 of their cycle to put it in, right? So if you think about what the follicle's doing, it's doing two things. It's ovulating and dropping an egg into the tract to be inseminated to hopefully become an embryo, and it's remodeling itself into the corpus luteum, which starts secreting progesterone. And by day 7, and definitely by day 15, 16, when recognition of pregnancy happens, those two things have got to be timed correctly. Now, even in a good estrous cycle, it doesn't always happen every time. But if you think about ovulation as a starting gun, then to me, that's why it makes so much sense that Mother Nature set it up that the CL forms from the follicle, right? Because here we go, we bring this good egg up, we drop it in the track, and now we got to have that CL ready. So like I said, the CL secretes the progesterone. If we get to day 15 and 16, and whether it's because conception didn't occur or because it was a weak embryo and it died off and it doesn't send a signal, now what needs to happen is we need to get rid of the progesterone. And again, this is all actually leading into the clock, right? So we need to regress the CL, because as long as progesterone is around, there's a progesterone block that in some ways stops that estrous behavior, stops another follicle from ovulating. So around day 15 or 16, if there's not an embryo there signaling its presence, we start to get pulses of prostaglandin, which kill the CL and regress it, bringing her back into heat with a new follicle. And so that's going to be your 18 to 24 days. And again, there's a lot that goes into this timing that we kind of gloss over, but is really important about the clocks. There's an interaction of the follicular waves, the progesterone block on the uterus, estradiol itself, that sets the uterus up to say, okay, we have a pregnancy, we don't want to regress the CL, we want to keep going. Well, we don't have a pregnancy, we need to regress the CL and ovulate a new follicle and try again. So estradiol, progesterone, two steroids, prostaglandin, a fatty acid, GnRH we give in synchronization protocols. It's the hypothalamic hormone that causes release of either LH or PG or luteinizing hormone or FSH from the pituitary. FSH is follicle stimulating hormone, like its name implies. It stimulates growth of follicles. Luteinizing hormone causes ovulation. But once again, if you go back to realizing what I said about that starting clock, then if you think about the name luteinizing hormone, it makes even more sense. You have to remember that it causes ovulation, but what it really does is it causes luteinization. It causes the follicle to change into a CL. And the actual definition of the word luteinization is going from a primarily estrogen secreting structure to a primarily progesterone secreting structure. So in synchronization protocols, we give that GnRH injection to cause an LH surge to try to cause a follicle to ovulate if it's at the right stage.
Well, Dr. Cushman sent us an article yesterday to kind of preface our brains with some of this verbiature and get us thinking on this wavelength. And I thought that the first sentence of the introduction was really, really good. And I'm probably going to put it on an AI school presentation. And it's the corpus luteum is a continuation of follicular maturation. And I think that's just such a sticky physiological point for people to get their heads around when they're learning this stuff, that the CL comes from the same follicle that bursts and gives you the egg. And it's just, it really helped put it together in my brain to really just think about it all in that singular continuation of, okay, that's going to be, you know, like you said, luteinizing hormone is going to ovulate and kick this whole thing off, but then it's gonna go out into space and enter, you know, potentially the reproductive tract where it can be fertilized and go on to create this whole other shift of profiles. The interesting part that I thought maybe might just need cleared up for myself, when we're talking about the progesterone block in the uterus, that's, you know, just essentially important, right? Because the body at that point is just going to be operating under the impression that it is pregnant. And so that's going to, if that's happening too late in a cycle, that can inhibit our ability to get a meaningful conception the next cycle if that timing is thrown off, correct?
Right. So again, the progesterone block is partially a lead into the clock stuff that we're going to discuss. And there's one more hormone that then comes into play, which is oxytocin from the uterus. And most people, again, that have been in childbearing parenting type years are probably familiar with oxytocin, or at least Pitocin, which is the synthetic one we use to induce parturition in humans when there's problems. But oxytocin has two effects. It works on the muscular side of the uterus, but it also works on the secretory cells of the uterus to cause prostaglandin release. Okay. So what the progesterone block that we're going to get to is really doing, at least for some period of time, is stopping the uterus from producing oxytocin receptors, which is what oxytocin has to bind to in the uterus to cause prostaglandin to be released. So again, like you said, Kiernan, we got this window of time when we don't know for sure yet whether we're pregnant or we're not pregnant, and we got to keep making the uterus think it is pregnant until we know by that signal from the embryo. But it's not just the lack of a signal from the embryo that causes that prostaglandin to start being released and the uterus to start killing the CL and starting a new cycle. The uterus itself has its own clock, which, like I said, is all about progesterone exposure and length of progesterone exposure that starts that clock going. And we can discuss that a little more as we go, but go ahead, Olivia.
Well, and that's kind of what I was maybe thinking we could do next. So you kind of laid out the estrous cycle, but now how about the concept of this uterine clock? You've mentioned the uterine clock. I guess in layman terms, what does that mean?
So as I just said, in layman terms, it means that the uterus itself and or the physiology is actually set up in more ways than just about whether there's an embryo there or not an embryo there to bring us back into heat or back into estrus, sorry. Other than that should be the cowboy term anyway, but to bring us back into estrus. So the uterus is actually doing its own complete thing. And in terms of producing the oxytocin receptor, estradiol is actually the hormone that causes production of the oxytocin receptor. So if you look at at least the initial paper, not the one from yesterday, but the initial paper, and you look at a lot of other papers, what you'll see is that expression of oxytocin receptor is really high in those first several days after estrus because you've had an estradiol input and as the CL forms. And then you lose oxytocin receptor for about 10 to 12 days as progesterone comes up, because progesterone blocks synthesis of the oxytocin receptor and blocks estrogen action. But what the clock does is progesterone eventually loses its ability to block estradiol action. So progesterone downregulates its own receptor over time. So you understand what I'm saying? So you've got progesterone causing a block, but as the uterus sees more and more and more progesterone over that 10 days, the progesterone's ability to keep the uterus quiescent starts to shut down. So the next place you see oxytocin receptors start to really come up is around day 15, 16 in the absence of a pregnancy. In the presence of a pregnancy, when that embryo sends its signal to the uterus, then it kind of blocks production of oxytocin receptor and all that type of thing. And now the CL is able to maintain. And I don't want it to sound like there's no progesterone receptor there, because there obviously still has to be progesterone receptor there to get through that window. It's just how much is there and this balance between the two things. So just like the starting gun on ovulation, the whole thing is a clock that when it's working right is set up to be carrying itself toward a pregnancy or toward the need to cycle again, with independent components working on their own, but also then coming together to cross communicate.
And so let's go back then to that first paper that you sent us, and let's maybe talk about how we can keep that uterine clock in a, I don't even know how I want to say it, but just keep that, it in a.
So that's the really hard part, right? We can do a lot, like I said earlier on, for the anestrus animals, we can do a lot to some degree with nutrition to probably get our anestrus animals jump-started and going. It's actually about the regularly cycling females. And again, this is a component that if you stop and think about it is true across mammalian females, right? We talk about that 18 to 24 days for a cow with an average of 21 days. We talk about all of them, but in all mammalian females, there's a subpopulation of females that are having irregular cycles, right? It's true even in women. And that's the harder thing. And that's kind of what the paper is showing, right? That we looked at the standard thing that Dr. Perry's worked on for years, that Dr. Geary works on, of is there an estrus during that time that we're setting them up for the timed AI? And if there is, then we know that that's beneficial because it gives the estradiol signal, which the uterus needs for gamete transport, for pH, and even to some degree for nutrient environment and all that type of thing. Everybody thinks about progesterone, but there's no question that our work through the years has shown that estradiol is just as important for that uterus 2 weeks later as progesterone is maybe during the estrus cycle. But so the animals that show estrus, you get a good priming on. The ones that don't show estrus during our synchronization protocol, that's where you get the irregular priming, whether it's estradiol and or less progesterone, and that's where you see those short cycles. And now you've got a case where the uterine clock has gotten knocked out of sync. So she potentially ovulated. We potentially used GnRH to force her to ovulate. We put semen in there. We're going to say that usually if those two things happen somewhat right, the conception is really close to 100%. But we also know that we have that loss in that next 2 weeks. And one part of it is those animals that didn't respond correctly, they're short cycling. So they never reach that day 15, 16 with a functional CL for the embryo to signal to the uterus and CL and let it know it's there. So we lose it because of that.
Yeah. So essentially going back to that uterine clock, when we see females, just to kind of break down what you just said. Yep. So when we have females that are showing estrus, so we're setting up our cows on a timed AI synchronization protocol, let's say a 7-day co-sync seeder. When let's we have it. Females that even show estrus prior to an estrus synchronization and respond to an estrus synchronization, if they do not conceive to that estrus synchronization, they are more likely to conceive at an earlier in the season based on their uterine clock being more regulated, correct?
Right. So in that situation, what's going to happen is we've done everything right, right?
Right. And
the only thing that didn't happen is for another reason, probably other than the steroids, that conception didn't last. It could be, you know, a bad gene between the, a recessive lethal that came together correctly between the sperm and the egg to make an embryo that just couldn't last. But basically she did everything right. So she's going to have that 18 to 24 day estrus cycle, come back in. She's regularly cycling, everything set up right. A lot, what the paper shows is that a lot of those animals that don't show estrus in that window are not necessarily our anestrus animals so much as they're the ones that are not cycling regularly. So if you even look at the paper I sent yesterday, you see that a lot of those girls underwent a short cycle without proper estradiol and progesterone priming, so they couldn't reach the recognition of pregnancy window. And in the production data side of that first paper, that's what we show, that even in the presence of the bulls afterwards, those girls that were not showing estrus correctly during the synchronization protocol had 20%, I think it is, lower conception rates to the bulls. It's about 20%, right? Yeah.
Yep. I believe you're right. 20%.
Yeah. I'm sorry, Dr. Cushman. By the way, your joke got me snorting out loud. So by the way, that was pretty good. so you're talking about the yes. I'm glad I was muted because I was snorting. So you're talking about this irregular cycles and looking on a management standpoint for cow-calf producers. you know, you're saying these females are set up right and everything is going good for the uterine clock. We can't see that. You know what I mean? No. We can buy estrus, of course, when they're coming into estrus or into heat. But most of the producers are saying, what am I doing wrong? Why am I having these irregular cycles? Because that is a very common thing that people are telling us now is, you know, I'm missing a cycle in there, or they're short cycling. You know, maybe they don't see that short cycle. It's happening. But they're not conceiving until that second or third cycle. So these producers are like, what's going on? I mean, how can I control this? What am I doing wrong? Or what I'm doing, you know, can you share some thoughts on that?
So the point that you just made, Robin, is the exact point that led us to timed AI, right? And yet, if you think about it, the strategy came along because the idea became that estrus detection is difficult. It's time consuming, it's labor consuming, and it's difficult, right? So you're out there and you're looking for that behavior. And yes, when the behavior is going well, it's pretty easy to learn how to observe that and stuff. But now what do you do with that female who you called an estrus today, and 7 days from now, she's in estrus again? And this actually gets really, really complex, because there's two ways to look at it. There's the short cycles that I just talked about, where she really can be in another true estrus. That CL just didn't last more than about 7 or 8 days, and her first wave follicle grows up large enough to produce estrogen. And so she's really, really in heat again. It's just only been 10 days, call it, or something like that, right? Then you've got the second thing that makes people struggle. And that's the fact that we call it a progesterone block. And we say that the progesterone block works on behavior as well as everything else. And yet, if you know things well enough, you know that we have pregnant cows that will stand to be mounted. It happens at times, and they're still pregnant. You can find it. So that it gets again back to there's this balance between progesterone and estradiol, and it's really very fine. So you can have animals that are pregnant or are mid-cycle, and they've got sufficient progesterone to maintain, but they have a follicle grow up that produces enough estradiol that you still see some degree of behavior. And actually, where we have fun with that is with our heat time system, right? So we have accelerometers and collars, and a lot of this research, part of the way we monitor it is using the electronic systems. And you can pretty much tell the ones where the CL hasn't regressed on an electronic system. I won't deny that, because you'll see the two heats peak on at 21 days apart. And like at that 10-day point when the follicle comes up, you'll see a heat, but it will be nowhere near the intensity of the heats when she's in a true follicular phase. So I realize I'm not helping you solve your problem, and I don't know that I have a solution yet. But what we are saying is that there are those females out there, and it's actually coming to the conclusion of realizing that people aren't necessarily detecting estrus wrong, or that type of thing. And in some ways, we continue to see these type of data even in natural service herds, right? So I'm not saying that there aren't places where it's bigger, especially if nutrition is bad. But most of the time, in my experience, in good nutritional management, whether we're talking puberty or postpartum, you're only going to have about 10 to 15% of the females that are not cycling by the start of the breeding season. And if you've got more, then you've probably got a nutrition problem. Now, we get closer to 25 to 30% of the females that we see these irregular cycles in, where they're just not getting themselves into the actual flow. And we do have a bigger overall fertility depression, even with the bulls in those girls, than we necessarily have because of anestrus. And like I said, this makes a lot of sense to me, because it still tells me we're having improper estradiol and progesterone effects on that uterus, and therefore we don't have a uterine environment that's able to sustain and or able to maintain the progesterone block long enough for a signal from an embryo to get there.
So those are the girls like on day seven or whatever day that the fixed time day is on a breeding protocol where you're going in, you're breeding these cows. You can tell that they're cyclic, but the patch on their back when they ran through has not been touched at all. They haven't been rode at all. And you're just, I don't, for me as a technician, that always makes me super nervous because you're like, gosh, I always like to be above that 70% of an estrus response, just as like a, an indicator that what we did was successful. And you know, those 30%, when you've got more than 30% that have silver patches, you're just always a little wary going, what did something get thrown off? Did a shot get given at the wrong time? Because, you know, when I was learning to breed, you're essentially kind of, you know, you're hoping and praying at that point. You're only hoping that maybe about 30% of those forced final day non-responders can potentially conceive. And so I guess my question for you, Dr. Cushman, is are you guys working on like an ovary defibrillator that kind of just zaps there and says, nope, do it right?
Okay. So just to be a little bit cautious, I'd say that's a lot of those girls, Keenan. I wouldn't say it's all of those girls, right? Because we know going back to the early days of OVSync and dairy cows and everything else, for a 7-day protocol, even though we know the theory of how it's supposed to work and that it should work no matter where she is in her estrus cycle, there are still windows where starting that first GnRH injection are better and windows where it is worse. So I wouldn't say that every girl that doesn't have a patch rub by the time we give GnRH2 and AI is one of those irregularly cycling girls, but there are a lot of them in that group, in our experience, quite truthfully. That's where the difference in split time comes up, right? If you use a split time AI and you only breed the ones that are have a patch rub this morning and you wait 24 hours, you're going to pick up another group of them that do get there. And then you still have a subpopulation. And I know some of my colleagues will argue with me, and I'm not saying that subpopulation has still gotten us to all the irregularly cycling ones, but a lot of what's left at that point is probably that noise in the system.
Well, and it's funny you bring up split time, because I was actually looking that up before this podcast, because I was going to maybe bring that up a little bit too, and how split time gives a little bit more additional time to allow that female to potentially ovulate to then, you know, get her bred. But I was also reading that they've had really variable results on a 7-day co-sync cedar with split time AI, and they've had almost better results in heifers on a 14-day cedar and an MGA or an MGA protocol, again, with heifers. So, and I don't know why, you know, heifers are just magical animals anyways. They just seem to do better all the time. But yeah, I was just curious at how split-timed AI and this uterine clock, you know, if there was any correlations in just kind of allowing her to maybe come into that natural heat, you know, if we're forcing that AI, if that's having an effect on that uterine clock, or by allowing her to, you know, wait an additional 24 hours, if we're, you know, kind of keeping that uterine clock regulated. I just wasn't sure.
So I think the biggest component driving that, Olivia, still is that if you go back to Perry's data or even all the historical data, we have certain rates of growth of good follicles, but there's a biological variation around that, right? And in some of those females, it's just that dominant follicle, and this can still partially be about the timing of getting rid of the progesterone and allowing the follicle to go, or the follicle itself. Some of the follicles are just growing at a slightly slower rate, but they're doing everything right. So giving them that extra 24 hours, you found them. I do love to joke once again and give a hard time, right? When split time started coming on the scene, I started giving all of our reproductive physiologists a hard time. I understand the reason for it, and I gave you the explanation for why timed AI is even good in some ways, right? But split time, if you do it over 2 days, now are you going to go to 3 days? And are we just getting back to the fact that AM, PM and finding a cow in heat and breeding her 12 hours later is the ideal situation? And again, there are a lot of reasons for timed AI in terms of labor and everything else. I'm not necessarily picking on it. I'm just saying, to me, the very concept of split time, brings us back to the idea that we all know instinctively that seeing a heat and doing the AM-PM rule is still your best way to go in terms of overall fertility.
Yeah, that's honestly where Kiernan and I had our first fight, was debating whether we were going to set cows up on a timed AI or if we were going to just, you know, set them up and breed off of heats. And I was like, I'm not doing that to 600 cows. Like, I don't have time to sit and watch heats on 600 cows. And it was a heated debate. And I was like, I understand where you're coming from. But
I think that was the point
labor...
of contention, though, was we didn't want to have, allocate somebody to sit out there and heat detect for 21 consecutive days. And that,
exactly. You
know, that's not realistic at most places.
Nope.
And again, so one of the ones that I had never thought about, especially coming from more of a dairy background, right, and being willing to synchronize an AI all the time because you have easy access to the animals. But one of the ones that I had never thought about mathematically until I got here, and our cattle ops manager actually said it to me one day, if you use your number, you know, and say, let's just say 70% estrus response, okay? So that's a 0.7, right? And if you say off a good estrus, 70% artificial insemination conception rate, that's a 0.7. And 0.7 times 0.7 is 0.49, right? And regardless of all the little juggles and all the little plays that we do with synchronization protocols and all, if you look historically at the timed AI data, in a pure timed AI situation, about 50% of the animals are going to end up pregnant most of the time, give or take. So 0.7 times 0.7 is 0.49. If you did the estrus detection and everything else, it's just that a lot of our producers feel more comfortable for the exact reasons you said or that I said about the split timed AI, because we realize all of that. But it really becomes a discussion about how many days you want to put into it, how much work, and do you like 21 days of estrus detection better than three runs through the chutes and injections and putting cedars in and pulling them out? And I don't think there's a right or wrong. It's about what your actual operation is and what you want to do and how it best fits your situation. In terms of your question about fixing those irregularly cycling females, it's a quick question that bugs me. It's what makes me a basic ovarian physiologist, because I would argue that we're going to have to get down to really understanding what's going on with those follicles and those CLs before we're ever going to be able to fix it. I don't think that in this case, it's as simple as a straight nutritional solution. One of the good things about a cedar, right, is that it provides 7 days of pre-progesterone priming on that follicle and on that uterus, whether it jumpstarts the cyclicity or whether we're synthetically helping the whole steroid situation in the clock, right? And again, to draw an analogy and hopefully try to put it in perspective for some people, we talked about all those women that are irregularly cycling, and what is one of the most common solutions on the medical side that's used for that? And it is the administration of birth control pills to get that irregular cycle going, right? So again, we're back to using progesterone and estradiol to bring that cycle to some degree back under control in a forced situation.
So in your mind, Dr. Cushman, are we almost, well, and I guess you kind of, it depends on the operation and it depends, but I guess just in the, along the lines of challenging my own thoughts and, you know, just defaults when I'm on call or on project, are we getting to a point where it may not even be worth breeding those non-responders, or are we tinkering with maybe trying to lower the price point of the semen that we're using to use a cheaper straw on those females? Or something that I was just thinking of that's way in the weeds, can we potentially identify a bull with a strong enough impact to create that progesterone block and signal that, hey, like, you know, just a super bull that says, creates embryos that scream, I'm here, don't short cycle me.
So if we're going to be weedy, thank you for being weedy, and I don't have to take the blame for getting there, but you hit on a whole bunch of weedy thoughts that are part of my idea. And for those of you that know Salo, this actually became a prelim question for Salo, and then he actually didn't answer it really well in his prelims, either in his writtens or when I challenged him again in his orals, but he actually got us there at his final defense, right? So I am now beginning to see evidence of something that we would still think about, that there are interactions between the male and the female, and that certain bulls work better with certain types of females and or vice versa, right? Now, I'm not going to completely be answering the irregular cycle thing, but I think it is potentially possible. I'm going to go back to the estrus, no estrus model in general. Now, Salo only had 6 bulls in his PhD work where they really looked intensively at all of that male fertility side of things. But this is the exact question I asked him, and because he was in Perry's lab, I asked him to think about the no estrus and estrus situation and describe that interaction. And whether I asked it badly or whatever, he couldn't understand the question until he got to his final defense, where at his final defense, he presented the fact that of the 6 bulls, one of those 6 bulls actually worked better with non-estrus females than with estrus females. So again, getting back to your strategy for management, and I'm not sure this isn't too hard for the average producer, but I'm not sure it isn't if you're really interested, right? I raised the question, okay, you're picking your bulls, you pick a couple of bulls. And in amongst that, you pick one of these bulls that you want his genetics, but that he does better on a non-estrus female. Now you've got your patches on, you do your timed AI, and when she gets up to the front of the chute and it's time to AI, or you look at your patch and you make your pick on whether you're going to put the estrus bull or the non-estrus bull into her on the basis of the fact that her patch is or is not rubbed. And I say all that, and I realize how much harder it is when you're doing 1,000 head or and all that type of thing, and you're trying to keep all of that straight and know where it is in the tank and all. But it's at least an interesting weedy thought. And I think, at least as far as my thought process has gotten, you're on the right type of ideas. And it makes me feel better, like maybe I'm not just running ivory tower thoughts through my thought process for this.
Well, and that is hopefully kind of, and not necessarily the end point, but that's kind of where the research is going, correct? Is kind of looking at some of these bulls and being able to identify maybe some of those markers or whatnot that are going to potentially work better in females that are displaying estrus and those females that potentially aren't. Is that correct?
I'm hoping we're getting it there now, right? I mean, it wasn't necessarily completely the start of Salo's PhD, but we kind of got there. And, you know, again, you argue 1 out of 6. What does that mean? It's very, very preliminary data. About the only thing it does for me and or George is get us to the point where we really want to start thinking about the fact that minimally, we don't want to think just about the bull and just about the cow, that there's also an interaction between their two physiologies that may be important to this whole thing.
Well, and I think when you have, you know, purebred producers, these seed stock guys that have, gosh, there was a couple that I worked with this spring and summer that it seemed like they had over 50 bulls in the tank anyways. So if you could line out a couple that, you know, let's try these on the non-responders and just see if, I don't know, maybe you could recycle some older stuff that someone's got a lot of, maybe make it one of those blasts from the past breedings. And I think there's definitely, I don't know, that's a little bit out of my realm, but it's just so interesting how important that, you know, it's so easy to forget that there's another 50% of the equation there that is talking too, especially, I mean, even at that young of an age, it's still contributing to that equation.
Yep.
And I was going to joke, with all this research, it really makes it look like the bull isn't at fault at all. So, but we know there's a little fault there. So we're not going to totally brush that under the rug. So this has been a really fun conversation. And in fact, I feel like this conversation could continue to go on for a very long time, just continuing to ask some of these questions. So I guess before we end, is there any other questions that you guys have for Dr. Cushman before we wrap these things up?
I don't really have a question, Dr. Cushman, but just very much actually appreciate you said a decade ago you talked about the cow longevity project. That is still data we utilize every day because that's still an issue. Longevity is still an issue. And cost of production keeps rising. I mean, we've heard that all the various input costs, whether it's land rent to feed cost, you know, hay, are not changing. They're probably going to be increasing. So we have to be able to keep those females in our herd longer and get them bred up earlier, like you said, because we're missing potentially with this irregularity, excuse me, that word is hard sometimes for me to get out. It's causing that spread in the calf population or the calving distribution and affecting our overall bottom line. So kudos on your work and thank you for doing that.
I absolutely agree. I still think it's the most important component of my research. Yes, I still call it fertility and I love fertility, but fertility in a single year is so much affected by environment and management versus understanding who those females with good reproductive longevity are for the bottom line. I still think we get a better handle in many ways, even if it's still questionable, on being able to identify those females to some degree than to absolutely tell you for sure who's going to breed and who's not going to breed in a single breeding season. And again, that gets us back, if I just have a second, the argument on antral follicle counts and that type of measurement. I think sometimes that everybody forgets that even I make mistakes in my antral follicle count data, okay? And no one is perfect. We work on a lot of technologies to try to make that work better. But if I come back to what I believe the answer should be, I do still come back to there are data out there to show why the answer should be that in general, the lower follicle count females are the less fertile ones over time. And that's actually the repeat breeder studies here at US Mark, right? Where we actually, back in the 80s, and then I got to do one while I was here, and that one's published. But the idea that we looked for cows that failed to breed in two consecutive seasons. Now it's a small component of the population, but you've moved it a little bit more back toward fertility because she's failed 2 years in a row. And when you take those ovaries out and you hold them in hand and you don't know. So when they came to my lab, we didn't know which ones were the age match controls and which ones were the twice opens. And we did the follicle counts. We had lower follicle counts in general, not absolute. The means over the standard errors overlap. They're significantly different. The standard deviations overlap. But the subfertile females had fewer follicles. I haven't been able to do another one of those studies because they're so expensive, but we've got a paper at Theragenology right now. We're finally able to do it in sheep here. So we took it even a little bit more extreme. We have ewes that were either open for 4 years or conceived for 4 years. And then I kill them, well, we necropsy them, and it's the geneticists that put them together. I don't, once again, me and my lab group do not know which group they're in. And then we collect their tracks and count the follicles, and the p-value less than 0.0001, the barren ewes, the 4 years open, have way lower follicle counts than the ones that were pregnant every year. And we don't have this in the sheep yet. We're working on getting it. But historically, in the repeat breeder cows, the progesterone has always been lower in those repeat breeder females. So the idea that there's a longevity component and an antral follicle count component and a steroid hormone and uterine clock component that all come together in this is there. I'm not trying to summarize that and make it sound like we've put it all together. It's where we're working. We don't have it all nice and neat and completely tied up in a bow. But when I look, I actually work from the opposite side of things. On my frustrated days, I try to find reasons to not work on antral follicle count anymore. When I have a bad data set, I'm like, okay, I'm out of here. And then just as soon as I believe I'm done with it, I get another excellent data set that makes me go, no, this is real.
Well, I think you put that really nicely, Bob, honestly, you know, talking about it really all does, it comes big picture if you think about it, and really looking at those females that are conceiving early, calving early, and just really how they're maintaining, and all those little factors that you just mentioned all come into play in that. And so when it does come down to, you know, some of these commercial guys that are, you know, setting up their cows and breeding their cows, what are some management decisions that can be done? I still think it goes back to some of those simple concepts of get that female bred early, pay attention to your calving distribution. And, you know, that female should be set up correctly to continue to get bred early and calve early through the remainder of her life and hopefully stay here long enough to wean enough calves to pay for herself. I think that's really kind of what you're saying it all comes down to. And then the cool part is we have people like you who get really into the nitty gritty of it and really deep dive and are trying to figure out physiologically what's occurring in this female and how can we maybe improve some of those numbers. But big picture, again, I think on a management side, it really comes down to good management, good nutrition, and getting her bred early, making sure she's calving on time, and just continuing that cycle.
Yep.
Can I ask one last question? I'm sorry, we're extending this a little far out. And Olivia, you can cut this out if you need to, but my question is through all the data sets that you've reviewed and looked at, has the number of females that are showing irregular cycles increased over time?
I haven't necessarily seen an increase in it, Robin, quite truthfully.
Okay.
And if you even think, one of the ways I used to explain this to my students sometimes in thinking about it is if you go back to the historic data from Cassata's lab and Hansel's lab and all the early reproductive physiologists, when they were characterizing estrous cycles, look at the first sentence in the materials and methods. And almost all the time, it's the fact that they picked 20 females, heifers or cows or whatever, that had just demonstrated three regular cycles or something like that. And those are the animals they use to characterize the regular estrous cycles, right? So again, my argument is that even the older giants on whose shoulders we stand realized that there were the females out there that were just not regularly cycling. Now, that's not the same as saying what the percentage is or whether it's changed or not. But my impression from what I can see is that it's been fairly constant. I could be wrong.
Maybe something to look into. No, that's great. Bob, I so appreciate this conversation. Like I said, I think we could continue to talk and go in so many different directions with this, but unfortunately, you know, we only have so much time. So Bob, it was so good to talk to you and having you join us on this podcast. Once again, this has been Cattle HQ, brought to you by SDSU Extension, headquarters for all things beef cattle. Visit extension.sdstate.edu for the latest beef information.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Cattle HQ, brought to you by SDSU Extension, headquarters for all things beef. We invite you to visit extension.sdstate.edu for the latest beef information, as well as subscribe to the show on Spotify. You will also find show notes and resources from today's episode. Until next time, remember, success is not a goal, it's a byproduct.